Just what is implicit bias and what can be done about it? A week ago, Starbucks closed more than 8,000 stores for a training on how to combat racial bias. This follows a highly publicized incident in which a Starbucks store manager called the police to remove two black men who were in the store. In its training session, Starbucks was hoping to raise awareness of the implicit biases most people have, including its employees, and to give them the tools to see people with more empathy. But some critics say these trainings don't work because implicit bias is so hardwired into the human mind and cemented by culture. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll explore the concept of implicit bias, what it means, how it manifests itself in workplaces, schools, and public spaces, and how to identify it in yourself. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Implicit bias has been in the news quite a bit lately, but what's meant by that term exactly? And if we understand it, can we even do something about it? Today, we're going to learn how implicit bias manifests itself and ways in which we can better understand our own beliefs. In the studio with me, Laura Liguori, Executive Director and Founder of MindBridge, which we'll learn about more in a minute. Laura is also a lecturer in neuroscience at Bates College. Regina Phillips is an adjunct professor at the University of New England School of Social Work. She's also the Grants and Community Engagement Coordinator for the Westbrook School Department. Prior to that, she managed the City of Portland's Refugee Services Program. And Susan Gardner is director of the Rising Tide Center and a professor of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Maine at Orono. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you aware of any prejudices you have, any implicit biases? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Laura, I'll start with you and then have you all chime in if you have a difference. So what is, we hear this phrase a lot, all of a sudden, implicit bias. What's the difference between implicit bias and prejudice, or implicit bias and stereotyping?
Sure. So at MindBridge, our definition of implicit bias are the unconscious neurobiological processes that support things like prejudice and stereotyping that ultimately have a negative influence on our behaviors towards certain groups. So that's sort of a heady definition, right? But I think the important part of that is the three layers that are there. If we start with the first layer, that's our foundational neurobiological processes that are at work, that thereby influences and perpetuates things like prejudice or our preconceived notions of others, that thereby creates these negative stereotypes and behaviors towards different social groups, many different groups along many dimensions of diversity.
All right, Regina, is your definition the same?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the stereotypes have been there for a long, long time. Not quite sure. Well, they've come from history of different kinds of things and different kinds of way people are treated that gets out there in society. And people get that stuck in their head. And whether it's true or not, there's always an education that needs to be done to make sure that people understand where people are coming from. And what their history is and what their experience is. And those experiences can change.
So when we're having training on implicit biases, what we're doing is training empathy.
Oh, it's all about empathy. It's about changing your attitude. It's about recognizing people and where they're coming from. It's about recognizing people's experiences. It's about, you know, all of those things. And so my history is different than anybody else's. And just because my history is different than anybody else's doesn't necessarily mean that I need to be treated any differently. It just means that I'm different and those experiences and those histories shape the way I am.
Susan, implicit biases we're almost wired for them, yet we can recognize that at the same time. Talk a little bit about why we walk through our day with implicit biases.
Sure. I think one of the points we try to make in a lot of the educational, professional development and trainings we do at the University of Maine is that this doesn't make you a bad person that you have these. This makes you normal. This is human behavior. Our brain has to have these shortcuts because otherwise we'd be exhausted. If every time I had to think about, you know, you look this way, and so therefore you're the pizza person. What does that mean? You're carrying a piece. You know, what? It's a way for us to just start making shortcuts so our brain is not overwhelmed. So there's nothing wrong with having these implicit biases. It's just that we put them into action where they can be harmful, stereotypical, or create some kind of a negative interaction with other people. That's where the problems come in.
I'm wondering if I can ask each of you to give me a real-world example of what is an implicit, what is a manifestation of implicit bias? Go ahead.
Oh, there are so many manifestations of implicit
biases. You can give me two or three.
It might be the way in which when you're teaching, you are specifically paying attention to a certain racial or ethnic diversity of student over another. It may be that you have an expectation of, say, doctors as male, right? It might be the way in which when a different ethnic or racial dimension diversity is across the street from you that you choose to cross the street, but you don't consciously have an awareness that you're doing that. So this is all the myriad of ways in which our unconscious processes give rise to these behaviors where we negatively differentiate someone else.
Okay, Regina, some more examples.
My examples are lived examples. You know, as an African-American woman living in the whitest state in the country, I have a lot of examples of implicit bias. several that I can think of. One, I was applying for a summer camp for my grandson, and somebody automatically assumed that my husband and I couldn't afford to pay for my grandson. And so the conversation was quickly turned to, we have a scholarship, and if you need a payment arrangement, then we can make that as well. And so it's like, no, you don't know any. And the person was very well intended. That's the other thing. This isn't about somebody who's just mean and somebody who is, excuse my expression, explicit bias. These are well-intended folks who, for some reason or another, you know, have, you know, other things in their brain that are telling them, you know, this is how you should think and, you know, and that kind of thing. So she was very, very well intended. She was just giving me the information. However, I took it completely different. I took it as I'm a poor black woman who cannot afford to send my son to summer camp. And maybe I shouldn't have reacted that way. I didn't say anything to her. I might have told my sister. But for me, it was very personal. And I think in these situations, you also have to take a step back for a couple minutes and just go, okay, wait a minute, let me breathe, you know, and kind of go from there.
Sure, I can imagine that because I know there have been times as a woman, someone has said something and I've thought, did they talk to me that way because I'm a woman or right. because of me? Am I giving them some sort of signal that I fill in the blank or is it how I'm dressed today? And I can only imagine if you're a racial minority on top of being a woman. Right. And then maybe even add a religious minority or something to that. You're always questioning what is that person's intention, even when you don't want to be.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead, Susan. What's an example?
So some of the examples we often talk about and were the focus of the grant that originally instated us on campus were around gender and STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, mathematics fields. And there's a lot of research out there talking about especially women being underrepresented in some of these fields and have the sense of, do I belong? And part of that feeling of belongingness is often transmitted by maybe the faculty. So the faculty themselves may have these implicit biases, knowing that these students are smart, these students are wonderful, but they transmit them in how they behave with them and how they interact with them. Some examples of some of the research that's been done on the University of Maine campus are things around faculty maybe going out of their way to only ask the women, how are you doing? Are you understanding this? Again, coming from a place of good intentions, I want to be supportive. But after a while, these women start to say, maybe they think I'm not smart enough. Maybe I don't belong here. And that these kind of interactions can ultimately make them decide they don't.
Okay, we're having this conversation during a week when this is very much in the national news. Starbucks famously shut down its stores and offered a training for its employees. I'm wondering what you all think. You conduct training, Susan. Some people have been critical of these. Say you can't change people with one training. What do you think of it?
Well, I probably am along, you know, in the camp of one shot wonders are not doing a wonder. That we do need a consistent and comprehensive type of way to think about these things. And that's part of the reason we exist on our campus, is to keep these conversations going, whether it's in the classroom or outside of the classroom or even in the community. For us, what we found is that you can change behaviors. And again, just as much as these implicit biases make us human, we can also overcome them. We learn them, we can unlearn them, but it takes practice. And so some of the trainings we've done are around things related to, for example, letters of reference. This is something a lot of academics do. We do them for our students, we do them for our colleagues. But there's been plenty of research out there that shows that sometimes women tend to have certain kinds of adjectives used to describe them versus men. And again, not coming out of a place necessarily of malice or malintent, but that what happens is that women will be referred to in more caring, nurturing terms, where men might be referred to in more agentic or, you know, taking action, leader, front of the pack kind of terms. And so some of the trainings we've done is we actually ask faculty to come and bring some of their letters and comb through them. And what they notice, I notice this in myself. This is somebody who does this stuff every day. I was doing that. So for me, now it's just this awareness of every time I sit down to write a letter, I make sure that it's well balanced and that I'm using those kind of terms both for men and women, because those are things we want for everybody.
You were going to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in on that for a little bit. So yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying, that it's really difficult to have these kinds of trainings be one-hit wonders, right? So a lot of the trainings we see them being done in a couple of hours, a few hours, or one day you check the box and you're done. But that's ultimately not what's going to really create change, right? And from a neurobiological perspective, that, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. Mm. You know, this process is an incredibly robust process. Our brains have been created over hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary history. This is an incredibly strong process. It's underlying a lot of these biases. I'm going to out myself for a second. I'm going to say I'm 42 years old. So we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of years worth of evolutionary history. We've got my 42 years of life experience. Those two are going to weave together to create an incredibly robust experience that it's going to be resistant to these kind of two-hour trainings. So what was hopeful with Starbucks is that there was some conversation for some time. So there was an acknowledgement with Starbucks that you can't do this for a couple of hours. They gained a lot of criticism. There was that article in The Atlantic, "Does Starbucks Understand the Science of Unconscious Bias?" And the author of that article made the comment that Starbucks has this opportunity to be that one company out there that's going to create this really comprehensive plan for tackling bias. And what wound up becoming was a six-hour training that has gained a lot of criticism. So this feels a little bit like a lost opportunity. In order to really create change, it has to be a commitment to a program that becomes a practice. Mm-hmm. We're not going to start running a marathon after having run just one afternoon, right? We're not going to get a graduate degree after sitting on a class for one class in one afternoon. In order to really be with implicit biases and all the complexity that's here that Regina was talking to, we need to be committed to a practice over time.
All right, Regina, and I want to ask you your response to what Starbucks did 1 week ago.
Yeah, so when this came out, I'm a Starbucks fanatic. I got the app. I get the free, you know, whatever. And, you know, I go to Starbucks quite often. When it came out, I said, okay, well, I can't go to Starbucks. Let me find another coffee place. And I didn't. For the longest time, I didn't go to Starbucks. And I thought, you know, I heard that they were going to close. They were going to lose $12 million to close for 6 hours. And so at first I thought, okay, well, now I can go to Starbucks on May 30th. Then I thought, you know, just like everybody else, it's not a one and done. You can't just go in and say you're going to talk about this. And again, I use that term as well. Check the box off and say we're all now diversified. We can now face the world. And it wasn't until I watched the show that Chris Hayes and gosh, I can't remember her name, Joy Reid did. And they talked to the folks. They talked to, they had, there was a panel, and I found out that Starbucks is working with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and there were several other organizations that they actually reached out to and said, we need some help. We need some help in trying to figure this out. We know it's not a one and done. We know we have to look at our policies. We know this is going to take a long time. So then I really, I mean, I had to give them some kudos, not to mention all the fact that all the stuff that they're doing in the community. So it was at that point I decided to go ahead and go back to say about Starbucks. But, you know, we were talking about this before we came. This isn't just about Starbucks. How many corporations out there are there that we don't know, I don't know what goes on a daily basis as far as implicit bias? You know, there was a situation with a couple or three people coming from an Airbnb, and somebody called and said that they were breaking in. So now I have to ask myself that question. So am I allowed to use Airbnb? Am I allowed to go on vacation? NFL is another prime example of, you know, do I watch the NFL? You know, I stand very proudly with the folks that took a knee. I completely understand that it is definitely not about disrespecting anybody, especially our military. I understand that, but somebody else doesn't understand that. So for me, this is a whole collection of things. It's not really just about Starbucks. It's about a bigger thing as to how we view things, how we live in the world, how we view corporate America. You know, it's all of those things. And I can't be afraid as an African-American woman to walk out my house and not just go about my day.
And that's, we posted the film that Starbucks showed its employees on our Facebook page and will as well on our webpage. And that's one of the points made in the film, that a person of color in America has a different experience than a white man just walking out their door in the morning, thinking about how he or she's going to negotiate their day is a completely different thing. And there are probably a lot of people out there who have never even thought about that. So we have to go to a break in just a minute. But before we do so, I promised I would talk about the projects you guys are involved in. Laura, tell me about MindBridge.
Oh, goodness. So MindBridge is a local nonprofit. So the tagline for MindBridge is that we use psychology and neuroscience to support human rights-based initiatives. So human rights, social justice, racial equity, LGBTQIA, immigration, refugee rights, and beyond. And so we subdivide into a whole bunch of different services, from running independent research for some organizations. For example, some organizations want to learn about what does it mean to be empowered and how can we integrate that into our programming. Some organizations need help in assessment. They're working on trauma or PTSD, and they need to understand that a little bit better. And then this is interwoven with my teaching at Bates, where we've just launched our ambassadorship program, where the neuroscience students are learning to responsibly engage with community organizations. So the students will be engaging in neurobiological research with community partners and really kind of building that bridge between science, research, and human rights-based application.
All right. Well, Regina and Susan, Regina and Susan, I'm going to have to ask you after the break because I have to take a quick break. We're talking about implicit bias on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach, working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
In a small city just outside Madison, Wisconsin last year, residents voted to fund a brand new high school. They wanted an open space with lots of windows. Then Parkland happened.
If we're in this fishbowl with all this glass, where do we shelter in place?
I'm Ari Shapiro. A look at school design post-Parkland, plus primary results, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. All three of the Your Vote 2018 debates are available online right now at mainepublic.org, where you'll also find the radio and television on-air schedule for the debates. This evening at 8 on Maine Public Television, we're airing the Democratic 2nd Congressional District primary debate. And tomorrow morning at 10 here on Maine Public Radio in place of On Point, you'll hear the Democratic gubernatorial primary debate. These debates, the on-air schedule, the candidate interviews and comparisons are all online at mainepublic.org/yourvote.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the programming, Understanding Implicit Bias. Joining me, Susan Gardner, director of the Rising Tide Center and a professor of women's, gender, and sexuality studies at UMaine Orono. Laura Liguori is executive director and founder of MindBridge and a lecturer in neuroscience at Bates College. And Regina Phillips is adjunct professor at the University of New England School of Social Work. She also works with the Westbrook Schools. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, though, I want to find out, Regina and Susan, about the projects you are working on. Regina, you teach a class at UNE with you and somebody who's Native American, I understand.
Well, no, she's a Hispanic. Her name is Arabella okay. Perez. And we put together a class with several community leaders, and it's called Empowering Cultural Education. And the class was offered this past spring. And it's really to teach folks, social workers coming out of the field, that there is a diverse community. And that diverse community includes Native Americans, includes the refugees, includes immigrants, it includes African Americans. And in social work, we really have to pay attention to those communities and those populations, because some of those folks aren't going to a lot of the organizations that they need to go to because of racism and discrimination.
Okay. And tell me about the work that you're doing, Susan, at UMaine.
Sure. So the Rising Tide Center was established back in 2009 as part of a National Science Foundation, and it was a $3 million grant to recruit, retain, advance women faculty in the sciences. And it was led at the time by now President Susan Hunter, and then subsequently by Provost Jeff Hecker, and several of us were the co-PIs and the writers of the grant. And what we tried to do is change that culture. We tried to change UMaine overall, and thinking about implicit bias, thinking about ways that maybe the institution stands in the way of women being successful. When the grant ended in 2016, we became institutionalized, meaning that now we are fully funded by the University of Maine. And we continue to do this work now beyond women faculty, thinking about equity, thinking about inclusive excellence overall. So a lot of training, professional development, research that we base all of our trainings on, and continue to work now with students and graduate students as well.
All right. We're going to go to Amy, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's so great to hear this group talking about implicit bias. It's so important for people to understand and address. But here in Maine, we unfortunately still see a great deal of explicit bias. Many incidents aren't reported, and people, if they knew, we think if people knew about them, they would work together to keep them from reoccurring. I'm with the Maine Human Rights Commission, but our organization is joining with a bunch of other groups to create a coalition called Unify Maine, including women's groups, disability rights groups, NAACP, Immigrant Resource Center, to work together to fight bias and hate incidents. And I'm wondering if you all have any experience working with coalition groups to help tell targeted groups that you're wanted here, because that's what our group is focused on doing.
Regina?
Oh, yeah. I'm a longtime member of the NAACP. My sister, Rachel Talbot Ross, is the president of the NAACP, and my dad, actually, Gerald Talbot, started the Maine Human Rights Commission. So I have that history of all of that, but definitely have a lot of experience working in coalitions. And myself and two other of my colleagues actually started Cross-Cultural Consulting Group. It's an LLC we just started in January, and so we're doing a lot of work and a lot of training on implicit bias and refugee and immigrants, the experience of folks coming here. I've been involved in many, many coalitions. I think that that's the way to go. I mean, you know, just having a lot of people in a room trying to figure out an issue and a problem, you know, is a better way to do things as opposed to trying to do it by yourself.
And there are a lot of other, Amy, it sounds to me like you're really paying attention to other ways in which implicit bias may manifest itself. I mean, we're kind of talking about race and gender here, but you brought up people who have a disability.
Yeah, perhaps because each of us is familiar with our own community, all of us have so many different parts of our identities, but we tend to hear about what's happening in our own communities. The goal is to share information so that all of us can oppose bias wherever it's happening for any protected class status, so that we can all join together and speak with one voice to say hate is not welcome here. No matter who it's impacting, it affects all of us. We have so many groups that have joined us. We're hoping that other nonprofit, nonpartisan organizations will also join, and individuals who are interested in supporting human and civil rights, like all of the folks on the panel. I just want to thank you for the work you're doing. We do have a website, Facebook, and Instagram, and Twitter that we're launching all that coincidentally today. So your panel comes, it's the perfect time for us to try to link with you and what you're doing.
Amy, I invite you to post anything, any information on our Facebook page. Really appreciate your putting links and things like that up there, and we'll do the same thing on our website. You know, it's interesting, though, because we're talking about two things that are linked but aren't the same. I mean, we're talking about hate, but we're also talking about people who would not self-identify as having any hate. And you both gave examples of people who have great intentions and maybe are coming from a place of love. If you're listening to this conversation and you think, wow, that maybe that's me. Maybe I'm the person who crosses the street because that person who looks different makes me uncomfortable. What then? What now? How? What's your advice, Laura, to how to think about your own reaction to people, how to change your heart, if you will, and recognize that within yourself?
Yeah, I think a big part of this conversation is sort of understanding the relationship between topics like implicit bias and topics like racism. That if we think about racism and structural racism, we can possibly define that as, you know, the structural, institutional, and cultural norms that coalesce to form inequality for groups. And so while implicit bias is related to that, it's not the same thing. So implicit bias largely stems from what Susan was describing earlier about our foundational neurobiological processes. So if we are understanding, if we want to understand our own implicit bias and the way in which that arises, or maybe the way in which it's related to things like explicit racism, there are a whole myriad of techniques that people can start to employ in the here and now. And so all of these, you can learn about any of these with any one of the trainings that our three organizations give. But I think two things that I sort of want to point out is, one, as we said earlier, making it part of your practice, slowing down. And in this society, it seems almost impossible to slow down long enough to become aware as to what our triggers are and what our behavior actually means. So really coming into that awareness is really important, and that takes practice over time. And I think the second thing that I want to mention about this is a willingness to get uncomfortable. Mm. We need to be able to get uncomfortable and to have uncomfortable, what some people term courageous conversations, right? And so at Bates, so I'm a lecturer at Bates, we just had our commencement. We were really honored to have Brian Anderson there giving the commencement address. And for some of you, you might know Brian Anderson. He's a renowned human rights lawyer. He's the founder, executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. And the Equal Justice Initiative is a Montgomery-based nonprofit that works on racial and economic equality. So he came, gave a wonderful speech about four ways that you can create change in the here and now. But in terms of our implicit bias and ways that we can start to mitigate that, he was talking about you need to get uncomfortable, that we can't create change without having a willingness to have kind of these uncomfortable conversations where we stretch ourselves, we learn to listen, we gain more knowledge about the experiences of others.
I'm going to go to Veronica, who's calling from Reedfield. Hi, Veronica. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. So I just want to talk a little bit about my experience with implicit bias and my perspective on it. So, you know, I'm Latina, and I feel like our society tells women, especially, that Black men and to a lesser extent Latino men are dangerous. And actually, statistically speaking, if you're a female and you're married, the person most likely to murder you is your husband. And my husband happens to be white as the driven snow. So I think that what can be really insidious about implicit bias is that the culture is telling you, you know, what is dangerous and what is safe, but actually those things can be completely contrary to what the statistics actually tell us.
Sure, Veronica, you're getting a lot of nodding here, but I want to ask you, when you say the culture, what do you mean by the culture? Do you mean movies? Do you mean...
Yes. Movies, books, television, the news, you know, anything like that. And I think that, you know, the stories that get told and the way that they get told, I think that it's you know, it's important that we recognize where the true safety and true danger in our society lies. And it's not often where we think. So that if I'm being followed down a dark alley by a black or Latino man, you know, that might feel very terrifying to me. But actually, the man that actually rapes me is going to be a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy, a student, right? Fellow student that I meet at a party where he brings me a drink. You know, that's where the real danger is. And I think that we don't talk about that as much. Where is the, you know, who in our society is really safe and who is really dangerous?
Sure, and I'm going to turn this back to you, Laura, because I think that human beings in general, their fears are not based on what statistically they should be fearful of, whether it's the other person or getting on an airplane or what kind of food to eat. We are not logical, are we?
No, we like to think of ourselves as being logical, right? We love to have these logical conversations, and ultimately it's not really logic that's driving the conversation. So I think that your caller is really onto something here. So when we talk about implicit bias at MindBridge, one of the things we talk about is that the line that divides the us from them, that's our biology. What that line looks like and who it's pointed towards, that's our culture and our society coming into place. So the realm in which our cultures and societies create those kind of preconceived notions. And these happen super early on. As little kiddos, we're really good at noticing difference. Right? We're really good at noticing, oh, this is a square, this is a circle. Around 5 years old-ish, we start to understand the beliefs and values of others. And then it's shortly thereafter that those two processes coincide, where we're now picking up these cultural cues of values and beliefs of others that are not really based in reality, that these are prejudices and stereotypes that are infused within our cultural reality. And that's when that starts to take hold. So these ideas take hold at an incredibly early age and ultimately drive our limbic systems. And so this is not the part of our brain that's necessarily driving our rational discourse. These are the parts of the brain that are driving our emotional discourses. And they're incredibly fast. And so it's really important to get an awareness of that. So yeah, so rational statistics not always driving the conversation.
Susan?
And what I was going to add to that is that, you know, I think about these things also being a parent of a 3-year-old and a 12-year-old who are experiencing some of these things in real time. And my daughter said, talk about me when you're on the radio today. So I'm going to talk about her. So my daughter O'Hara,
my
recently,
daughter would say the opposite, but come on.
Don't talk about it. She came to me with a point, and I'm not going to repeat it because I don't want to embarrass her, but it was very incorrect. And I said, where did you hear that? Where did you learn that? And it was just exactly implicit bias kind of playing out. And what we talked about then subsequently, me and my husband and her, were, you know, how can we be literate with the information that we're hearing? And so kind of getting to the caller's point of, can we find data? Can we find statistics? Can we find research? And so that's what we ended up doing, is saying, you know, take your phone and go find something that supports the point, because she wanted to argue it and dig her heels in. And what she ended up finding out was enough sources to say, actually, it's the opposite of what you said and what you've heard, and trying to get them all to stop and pause and then also be humble. I think this is a big part of being human, is that we make mistakes and we have to recognize, oops, I was wrong.
And I hope it was your 12-year-old
child, not your 3-year-old child, doing this research.
Right. She's not quite good with the phone yet.
Yeah. Regina, is there something you'd like to add?
No, I completely get it. I mean, again, it gets kind of back to the conversation that we've had about education. For me, it's all about educating people and not having a one and done. And the reason why you can't do a one and done is because there is so much information out there, and there's so much implicit bias, and there's so much stereotype, that to kind of try to weave through all of that and understand all of that and change your mind and all of that and actually have it sink into your mind takes longer than 6 hours. And so that's why it's so important to, even though you've shown a film and even though you've gotten everybody in a room and you've done these trainings, there's just so much more out there that needs to be taught and educated. I have his actual birthday is today. Happy birthday, Walt, even though I know he's not listening. But I have a son who's 35. He's 6'2", and 150 pounds. And I constantly worry about him. There was one situation where he went into the grocery store with me. He had his hood on. I immediately looked at him and said, "You have to take that hood off. You have to. People are going to follow us." And he's like, "Mom, first of all, I'm not doing anything. I should be allowed to wear my hoodie in the grocery store." And so we had a conversation about that. But it's a scary time. It's a scary time for all of us. And I think education, and being transparent and being honest, having a courageous conversation, you're not going to get anywhere if the person in the room is not going to be honest with you to say, you know, "Hey, I'm scared by that Black person who walked by me the other night." It's not going to get you anywhere if you're not going to be honest and open and willing to hear what others have to say to you when you openly say those things. We want to hear that. We want to be able to deal with that.
If you have any questions about implicit bias, maybe recognizing it in yourself, helping the community, whether it's your school or your workplace, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We are going to take a quick break, but before we do so, a quick note about tomorrow's program. It's going to be a conversation about arts education in Maine. If you'd like to share comments or questions ahead of time, you can send us an email, a tweet, or post on our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Friends School of Portland. For preschool through grade 8, teaching peace in a changing world. More information at friendsschoolofportland.org. And Houston & Company, designers and builders of custom fine furniture, with a showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport, and online at houstonandcompany.com.
I'm Razia Iqbal. In a time of fast-developing news and headlines, NewsHour is there to help you make sense of a complex world.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. You will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
That's NewsHour from the BBC.
BBC NewsHour, weekday mornings at 9 and weekend afternoons at 4 on Maine Public Radio. Today and tomorrow, Maine Public Radio will present the last two Your Vote 2018 primary candidate profiles in our 2 o'clock hour. Next Tuesday, June 12th, Maine voters will choose the Democratic candidate for the 2nd Congressional District seat and the Democratic and Republican nominees for governor. You can find all these conversations online anytime at mainepublic.org/yourvote. There, you'll also find our debates for on-demand viewing, our television and radio on-air debate schedule, and the latest election news. Today's Your Vote 2018 candidate profile program features Janet Mills and Mark Eaves. Both are Democrats running for governor. That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Addressing Implicit Bias. I have 3 guests with me in our studio. Regina Phillips, an adjunct professor at UNE who also works at the Westbrook School Department. Laura Liguori is executive director and founder of MindBridge. Susan Gardner is director of the Rising Tide Center and professor of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at UMaine. Give us a call, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Before we get back to calls, though, I want to ask you all about another term we hear thrown around. I'll just throw it out there, microaggressions. What is a microaggression?
So microaggressions are small events. They're hard to prove. They often happen in covert ways that ultimately result in the othering or dehumanization of someone else. So, for example, these behaviors might be that you're taking more questions from men than from women, or that you're making eye contact with the males in the room rather than the women in the room. You are interrupting somebody mid-sentence. And so these can be particularly difficult barbs because they're hard to pin down. They're hard to really identify for the person who's on the receiving end of microaggressions. But this is definitely one of those things that seems a little bit like death by a thousand cuts. They're things that surround us at all times.
Mm. Susan, how can one be aware if we are guilty of microaggressions or implicit bias? How do we even know?
I think some of the training we've also done around actually microaggressions with our Center for Innovation and Teaching and Learning is that it might be that we are noticing how other people react to something we say. It might be, you know, when we talk about it in the classroom, watching how students react to one another and making the decision about, are you going to say something in that moment or are you going to have a conversation later on? But also realizing when we do it ourselves. And again, that humility of saying, wow, I messed up. And that's hard to do. I'm guilty of it myself. We all do this. Again, it's very human. But being able to say, you know, I'm sorry. I recognize what I did, and that might have hurt, and I didn't mean to do that.
Mm-hmm. And Regina, do we sometimes absorb these microaggressions in such a way that instead of thinking the other person has done something wrong, that we somehow, I don't know if the word is deserved it, but you know, I think it's human nature to try to make things nice and please the other person. And so instead of assuming one thing, we're assuming something else. And it's about ourselves and not the other person.
Oh, I totally agree. And it's all about lived experience. It's all about your lived experience. And I mean, you gave a good scenario of people getting older and bigger and, you know, that kind of thing. And the experience that folks have lived, the history that folks have endured or celebrated or whatever, gives rise to all of our different personalities. And so I had a woman told me recently, she came up to me, I was in a meeting, and I had said something about, you know, whatever. And she came up to me and told me about a dance she was at when she was in the sixth grade and how she got in trouble because she was dancing with a black guy. And, you know, very well-intended person. I didn't give you the whole context, but I was just kind of blown away that we're kind of still living in this world where it reminded me of, you know, I have a black friend, you know, kind of a thing. And so, again, it's all about the well-intended person. And what their experience was as far as how they interact. I really believe microaggression and implicit bias are really the same thing. I think we're talking about the same thing. It's unconscious. People don't know it. I think we have to try and call it out. I think you walk away from people sometimes and you go, wait a minute, did I not? And that's the time to either call the person to come and check it out. It's all about being open and honest with that person. Hey, remember I said this. What do you think about that? You're going to have a conversation about it. And within that moment, somebody might be able to teach you that, yeah, maybe you were being, you know, a little bit biased, or maybe you did say that thing and it was a little, you know, a little microaggression. You never know. So you might as well talk about it and see what happens.
All right. We're going to go to Jessica, who's calling from Gorham. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much. This is a great show. You've touched on this a number of times throughout the program, but I'm interested in some discussion around when and how it is appropriate to discuss for parents to discuss these topics with children, particularly with white children growing up in a largely white environment.
I had this moment with my three-year-old where we were reading a book and she pointed out skin color of someone else in the book, and I should note that she's white. And I had this moment of recognizing, you know, being the white estate, that as much as we expect that children are learning these things and seeing these things, that they're not. And for me, it was this moment of recognizing, almost all of her books only have animals in them. And that was a disservice that we were doing. You know, and it's a little thing. But to say, you know what, we need to get books that have people in them and have different cultures and talk about skin color and all these things. There's wonderful, wonderful tools and materials out there. So, you know, we started doing it at 2. And we continue to have these conversations because I think they're important, especially in Maine.
Yeah, I think you can never start too early in having these conversations with your kids because, as we said, they're picking up on your social cues and they're picking up on others' social cues. And one of the books that I was reading with my daughter was The Red Comb. And so I'm Puerto Rican, so my daughter is part Puerto Rican. And this story is placed in probably Puerto Rico with a runaway slave. And so there's very much these conversations around race and racial justice and social justice. And she started reading this as a very, very young girl. And so we didn't quite have the conversations around slavery at that point when she was super young. But this was a story that's really stuck with her. And every year it feels like a little bit of an unfolding. Every year we go a little bit deeper into the meaning of this story. Mm. And even though it's a picture book and she's now 8 years old, this is something that has sort of traveled with her as she's gotten older and gained a greater awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was going to say is, you know, we're living in a time where there's just so much learning that can be done. You know, we're sitting here, we're talking about implicit bias, and I'm thinking about when years ago when I was a young child and my parents had their best friend was a gay woman. I don't remember my parents having a conversation with me to say, she's gay. I remember my parents having a conversation with me to say, this is our friend, we love her, she loves another woman. And at that point in time, that was as simple as it needed to be. I don't remember thinking that it was wrong to love another woman. I don't remember, you know, being afraid of her because she loved another woman. And so I just remember just being a natural conversation. And I think that that's what it needs to be. I also think nowadays with all of the marches, the Women's March, I had a chance to take my grandson to the Women's March that happened a year and a half ago. And I truly missed a golden opportunity to bring a 5-year-old there to talk to him about why so many women were marching down Congress Street. And that's why I'm excited to live in this time, because there's so many issues out there that we deal with every single day that you can get your children involved in, and you can just automatically have that natural, authentic conversation.
Thank you, Jessica. I think we have time to squeeze in one more. Wait, go ahead, but please be quick. I'm sorry, we're getting toward the end of the hour.
Oh, I can be quick. My name is Wade. I'm a white retired psychotherapist. And one day a gentleman appeared at the door. He was African-American in an old overcoat. And my immediate response to him was, sir, if you'll come back later, I'm sure I can help you out with some food or something. And he said, excuse me, Mr. Macklin, I'm here to become a client. And I just was blown away with this unconscious response that I had. So anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you for your honesty. And wait, did you find that this made you think about other things as well?
Oh, sure. Because I see myself as liberal and egalitarian and open. And then it just pops up when you least expect it. And I must say that the client and I just had many, many chuckles about that initial reaction I had.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that with us. Any of you have comments for Wait?
I just love that example. And I love that they continue to work together and talked about it and probably unpack that over time. And I think that that's a really important part of the process. We're going to trip. We have implicit bias. If you have a brain, you have implicit bias. So when you trip, having the courage to really sit with it and say, wow, I messed up, and how can I do better next time?
That's right.
Well, wait, everybody is nodding here, and thank you for calling in. And that is the end of our hour. Thank you all for being here today. Really interesting conversation. Laura Liguori, you just heard her voice, executive director and founder of MindBridge, as well as a lecturer in neuroscience at Bates College. Regina Phillips is an adjunct professor at the University of New England and also works at the Westbrook School Department's Grants and Community Engagement Coordinator. And Susan Gardner is director of the Rising Tide Center and professor of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Maine, Orono. Roddy Nickpour ran to The Board Today, Maine Calling, is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Arts Education in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.